Thank you all for joining us for the first meeting of the university version of the Clinton Global Initiative. Again, I want to thank Tulane University and the mayor and the New Orleans community for welcoming us. As I said earlier, we have nearly 700 students enrolled. I think they're not quite all here yet, but more than 600 are, from 40 states, 15 nations, over six continents, representing 260 universities. Some have come from as far away as the Afad University for Women in Sudan, Lagos State University in Nigeria, Al-Quds in Israel, and the Academy of Dramatic Art in Zagreb. Every student here will make a commitment to fight climate change, tackle the global health crisis, address human rights issues, or alleviate poverty. Each is pledged to do something to make a difference on campus, in the community, or halfway around the world. All the way from urging university bookstores to change from paper to mesh bags, to raising money to bring life-saving medicines, to people living with HIV/AIDS in Uganda, or pledging to help residents right here in New Orleans rebuild their city better than before. I want to announce two more commitments now, and begin by asking Julie Carney, an undergraduate from Yale, to come up and join me. She is involved in the work of the Artemis Project. She will help to launch its online network to provide truth commissions a place to store and share oral histories of survivors of atrocity. Truth commissions will be able to upload digitized documents to a central database. The Artemis Project will work with commissions who do not have the technology available to them to ensure that they, too, can be part of the project. It will work with consultants to design a secure and interactive online network easily available to scholars and other survivors, and to have information from at least five different truth commissions online next year. Let me say this is really important. I have obviously been involved in a peripheral way for the last several years with the work that Nelson Mandela did. I know a lot about the extraordinary commitment and expense that Steven Spielberg went to with the Shoah Foundation to recapture about-to-be-lost stories from the Holocaust. And this is a simple and profoundly important historical idea that will give us the chance to simultaneously and at the lowest possible cost preserve the stories as well as the historical record of things going on around the world that we dare not forget. It is a miracle, in effect, that Steven Spielberg was able to go back in time and had the resources and had the commitment to do what had to be done with the Shoah Foundation. Now, because of the Artemis Project and Julie and her contemporaries and what they're doing, we will be able to do all this in a simultaneous fashion and not have to face the loss of our collective memory and other similarly compelling circumstances. So I think this is a really important thing, and I thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Now, I would also like to invite Elizabeth Coleman, the president of Bennington College in Vermont, up here. Bennington is committed to create a Center for Democratic Citizenship and a new liberal arts. The center will first be a green facility scheduled to open in 2010 and will use a problem-based interdisciplinary approach to involve scholars, practitioners, and activists involved in workshops, labs, and forums to spark discussion, refine understanding, and implement projects. The university, Bennington, is committed to invest a lot of money in this, $40 million over a decade, to expand this program to engage and impact students and to redefine the priorities of liberal arts education all across the nation. I'm very impressed by this, and I should also say that the people who make these commitments will be reporting back on their progress over the duration of the commitment so that the impacts can be measured. So I'm very grateful, and Madam President, I thank you for your vision and for your commitment. Thank you. I guess I should, if I could, let me hype this a little more than I have, because I think it's easy to forget. The vision of a liberal arts education as somehow quaintly anachronistic, I think, is wrong. You know, first we had this idea that everybody in a new age of high technology with the dominance of science and the decoding the human genome, that and the fact that we do have an evident shortage of people trained in science and math and technology that is aggravated by gender and ethnic considerations, I think has tended to denigrate the whole idea of liberal arts. So then its defenders have risen up. This is an attempt basically to go beyond essentially a false debate and say that you can study the basic subjects of liberal arts and also figure out a way to practically apply them in a way that will change other people's lives and measure whether you actually know what you're doing or not. So I really think it's very important potentially and could spark a lot of other colleges and universities that are not involved in this kind of work to do the same thing. So I thank you very much. Okay, that concludes my opening remarks. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. Yes. Well, first of all, it's always been my position that New Orleans would get more money for rebuilding from private sources, not less, if it committed to a sustainable rebuilding policy. That if we raise the standards for all new buildings and raise the standards for retrofit for non-residential buildings, if we engage the major utility, Entergy, and others in maximizing green energy and energy efficiency, that actually it would generate more money coming into the city, make more people interested in coming back or coming here for the first time, and lower the cost of living for its most at-risk working people, its lower-income working people, because the monthly utility bills would go down. You know, a lot of New Orleanians, for example, have went to Houston after this. The mayor of Houston, Bill White, it's the other major city in the South where we work, they're about to adopt the most stringent new building standards of any city in the United States, second only to Vancouver in all of North America, and their green building standards. And he has already launched a major energy retrofit or efficiency movement in low-income neighborhoods in Houston, some of those houses are occupied by Katrina exiles. And he said just with a fairly modest effort, they achieved an average reduction in greenhouse gases and therefore in utility usage and therefore in utility bills of 20% per house, which is like a huge tax cut for low-income working people in Houston. That kind of thing can be done in New Orleans and with the rebuilding, which is why this project Brad Pitt's trying to do is so important. These things take longer to get off the ground than you want them to, but if you do it right, you can do it in a hurry. So what our two people do here in New Orleans who work with the city is to try to find ways to come up with appropriate building standards and other things that can be done to deal with climate change in a way that promotes more sustainable incomes for people of modest means and more sustainable development for the city. That's what they're doing, and it's what we're trying to do around the world. Well, it's different in different places. I mentioned in my opening remarks, for example, the mayor of New York and I announced a very specific project in New York City where we're going to redo the public housing. But you have to understand, in New Orleans, it's like any other area that's been hit with a natural disaster. Anything related to housing always takes the longest to get going. I mean, when I worked as the tsunami coordinator in Southeast Asia for 2 years for the UN after we shut down the Bush-Clinton tsunami effort and before we started Katrina, or about the same time, it drove me crazy. It was always the hardest thing to do, to get the housing up and going, get people out of the temporary housing and reorient it. It was easier for us to start economic development projects and other things. So what I'm trying to get this done is energy as an economic development project. I should say that we also have funded to the building of two green schools in New Orleans, which should prove the point I'm trying to make, that you can operate the schools less expensively, create more jobs doing it if you build the schools right. And then my goal is to, in effect, create 5 to 6 years worth of work here, whether it involves me or not, by proving that all this makes sense. Then, even assuming you've maximized the rebuilding potential in the lower Ninth Ward, you still got every public building, every school building, every college or university building, every hotel, every office building, and eventually all the residential neighborhoods of New Orleans. You just think about how many jobs you could create doing nothing but going in and making those structures more energy efficient and using as much green power as you could. You've got 5 or 6 or 7 years of hard work here where you could basically restore the entire employment base of New Orleans only on changing the energy future. And I think that we ought to look seriously at that, and that's my long-term goal, to try to persuade the mayor, the city council, all the people, any kind of political influence here, that the way to really get New Orleans all the way back and all the way back in a hurry is to rebuild in the right way and make a long-term, 5-6 year commitment to create a much higher base level of jobs through this whole energy efficiency thing. And one of the things my foundation can do is to make sure that you don't have to pay any money to do this. That is, most of this work under our system can be financed entirely through lower electric bills. I mean, that's what we're doing in New York. All we have to do is come up with the money to pay what's called an energy service organization, a premium, to go in. Let's say, I'm making this up, okay, let's say there are 200 buildings in the New York Public Housing Authority, okay? And let's say that the newest one was built 15 years ago and the oldest one was built 75 years ago. Just to give you a first, okay. So if you hire an energy service organization that's really good at this, they'll go into each one of these buildings and they will tell you, okay, in the 75-year-old building, we can cut the energy usage and therefore the utility bill 30% if you spend, I'm making this up, $100,000 to do these five things, okay? If you pay them a premium, they will guarantee that. They will guarantee that savings. Once they do that, then the New York City Public Housing Authority can get a bank loan to hire all the people and buy all the materials necessary to do this work to be paid for entirely by the lower electric bill. That is, no upfront money. Because if they miss, the energy service organization makes up the difference. Now, what this means is that you put all these people to work, you green the buildings, you reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and you do not pay one red cent more out of the operating costs of public housing. The same mechanisms, by the way, are available to all colleges, universities, all public schools, all government buildings. Then, when the money is paid off, you have trained new workers, you have improved the economy, you have reduced greenhouse gas emissions, you have given the public housing authority free power back, and now the public, you've given the utility free power back, and now you have lowered the bill of the New York City Public Housing Authority by $150 million a year, which can be put into poor people's housing and other needs. And this may sound too good to be true, it's only because we don't do it enough. And we can do this everywhere. That's why our foundation was able to raise $5 billion in bank commitments in an afternoon. All the press today is about all these investments in credit markets and derivative instruments that have led to instability. These are good loans in direct job-creating operations which save the planet for our kids and grandkids and have just about as close to automatic payback as you can get. So anyway, that's a very long answer, but I just wanted to be explicit so you would know this is what my goal is in New Orleans, in Houston, in Philadelphia, in every place where we work, and in 40 cities on 6 continents. We are now doing 660 elementary schools in the city of Paris like this. And in developing countries where we're working, like, for example, in the run-up to the Olympics, we're working in Beijing and Shanghai. We're working in Delhi and Mumbai in India. In those countries, we're also often working on water systems and wastewater management systems, sewage systems, on the theory that, you know, that the environment there is, that's an energy-intensive thing, and with all this organic material, you have methane gas emissions, which are even more powerful than CO2, just not as many of them out there. So anyway, we're working on this around the world. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people look at those Sudanese lost boys. I mean, that's the most evident thing. That's what a sense of outrage or the inability to accept the way things are sparks a lot of political and social and citizen activism. I mean, you know, you wish in your heart of hearts that both those impressive young men who were speaking today had never had to. I mean, well, I think our country's better that they're here. And you heard them say, we issued basically a general permission for the Sudanese war orphans to come to the United States when I was president, my second term. So it was a big deal to me. But in your heart of hearts, you wish that they could have grown up and had normal childhoods and never had to leave their homes and their neighborhoods. Now, a lot of them have become all the more remarkable because of it. But it's because they know that in some ways they're living for two or three people. Think about all the people who didn't survive this process. So that's all I meant to say. I think that almost all these people that listen to the are in a less violent context, think about what the young student from Xavier in New Orleans said today about growing up in a town with a poor population next to a chemical industry where she wasn't sure that there was any commitment to environmental activism and protection for low-income people of color. And while that drove her into the activism that she was in, I think, you know, a lot of these people, Lance Armstrong is doing this, he'd probably, you know, be a sports commentator today instead of one of the great advocates for diagnosing, preventing, and living with cancer if it hadn't happened to him. I mean, I think all I was saying, all anybody was saying is we take the life that happens to us as well as the life we make happen and figure out where to go from there. Just about 100% of the people do that. Yes? Well, I think you have a lot of young people active in it, all across the spectrum, and I think that the fact that technology has amplified the individual efforts of people, and this is true all over the world. I mean, you remember the first commitment we just announced here, right? This would have been inconceivable a few years ago. And we're going to collect all these terrible things that are happening so we never forget and people's stories are preserved. And we can do it in real time because of the Internet and because of, you know, I could be given a speech in a room to 10 people and all of a sudden it'll be on YouTube the next day because somebody took a movie of it over a phone. You know, I think that and since the young are more not only more aware than ever before about the impact of events on their future, but also more empowered through this technology, relatively speaking, than older people are, I think their influence has been even greater than it has been in previous elections. There were a lot of young people involved in the election in 1992 also. Not just for me, for a lot of candidates, because it was one of those sort of breakpoint elections where people want to change the direction of the country. But I think the technology has dramatically increased all of that. Yeah. Well, first of all, I expect that the other students who are here will get more out of being with you than you will out of being with them because you had no option but to act. But here, for example, at Tulane, I was you know, former President Bush and I spoke at the commencement here. Remember this a couple of years ago? And before we came, we were given a fairly exhaustive briefing of what the students were already doing. So I guess what I would say is, if you ask me what more I wish you would do, I just think it's very important that you have longer-term plans, that you realize when something like this happens, it takes a good while to make the area whole. What you really want to do is to give people a new and better future, and you want to avoid the problem that you had before. And I think there needs to be citizen activism on all these fronts, both in lobbying the government for different policies and maybe more money where appropriate, and in doing different things. That's my first thing. The second thing is, I just hope that as the city comes back, that you will be able to maintain an ongoing commitment. I mean, I hope, for example, you'll be able to keep your, after as the seniors graduate and become alumni, I hope you'll be able to keep an ongoing commitment to this sort of work here, because I think that we're being given an enormous opportunity, but as all of us who've been working here know, it's also frustrating, right? Everything takes twice as long as you think it should. And you think you're pushing a rock up a hill, it falls back down again, you got to go push it up again. I understand all that. But I think that if you can sustain this and sustain your students' interest a little bit, at least to a little bit, even if they just give $50 to the effort or something ongoing after they graduate, I think that you will see within 5 years from now, you're going to look back on this and see we're in a way better place, and all the students will be able to say, we had something to do with this. Yes? Well, I think you just, you can look at the data same as anybody else and draw your own conclusion. I think you have to know, I guess I should back up and say, since my foundation, you know, is a 501c3, I don't want to be monitored for violation of the crossing the lines here. I just think, identity politics has always been a part of political life in all democracies and even non-democratic societies. And you look at the numbers and see that, and it changes over time and through different elections. But all people tend to and gravitate to people with whom they identify. So there's all elections are partly rational, partly emotional. They're all partly, you know, it's all like that. And you just, people look at the information and draw their own conclusions about that. But I think that that doesn't mean that the debates don't matter, because all elections move at the edges, keep in mind. In a national election, a 6% difference is a landslide election. I think President Roosevelt's last term, he won by less than 6%. One of his elections was around there anyway. And so what that means, you just think about it. You go from 53 to 47. If three people go from this side of the aisle to that one out of 100, three people out of 100, then you have a 50-50 race. If four people go, you go from a landslide to a narrow loss. So you have to understand that doesn't mean that. So in all politics, there's partly identity voting, then there's excitement voting, and then there's passion about issues and passion about candidates for personality reasons as opposed to identity reasons. It, you know, it's just all it's a combustible mix, and it's important that people just try to, you know, figure out where they are in it and do what they think is right. Anything else? Yes? First of all, I have to be careful getting in trouble with the laws, because I'm afraid my answer will closely track a certain position. But I think that the suggestion that there ought to be in the White House a coordinator for finishing the job of Katrina and Rita reconstruction and relief is a very good one. I mean, we just have to keep pushing the federal side of this to make sure not that we override what the city wants to do or jump the gun on something before it's ready. But, you know, the Congress has appropriated a lot of this money that's just sitting there, as I'm sure you know. And so I think there needs to be a federal coordinator for relief to make sure that this thing is driven as hard as possible. And driven, this is my opinion now, driven as green as possible. Because I'll say again, that is the key. If New Orleans could take its ancient history, Jean Lafitte, the Battle of New Orleans, right? Its unique culture and opening to the Caribbean and beyond, and a commitment to a sustainable economic future. Those three things would allow its complete ascendancy, its return, as the most unique city in the country. And you'd have something about yesterday, something that's ongoing about your culture, and something about tomorrow to present to the America and the world, and to your own people that you want to come home. So I think the most important thing the federal government could do is say, this is important to us. Scream it from the rooftops. We're not going to let you feel bereft and drifting out there, so we're going to have a coordinator on this. The coordinator also could see to the proper implementation of Senator Landrieu's bill, you know, that generates more revenue from the oil and gas leases in the Gulf to try to rebuild the barriers. Look, I saw a Corps of Engineers study that said that if the wetlands had been in the same position on the day Katrina struck that they had been 30 years earlier, if we hadn't just torn down all the wetlands, that the speed of the water coming through that canal would have been one half what it was, which means I think there is something like a 90% chance that it would not have broken. And less, only about 10% of the damage that was done would have been done. It would have changed everything. So this, all this stuff that my mother used to tell me when I was a little boy about an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure is certainly true in the environmental area, which is why we're in a race against time with global warming. So that's true. All of this would be better done if there were a federal coordinator. So that's the first thing I think is important. I think there should be a federal coordinator. Then I think there should be a sustained and ongoing commitment to make sure that the government agencies are operating functionally. You know, I have a particular insight on this because, you know, more than 10,000 trailers are now at the airport in a little town in Arkansas where I was born, because my little town, hometown, has a very big airport going back to World War II. So all those FEMA trailers that are infected with formaldehyde that had to be hauled out of the area are on the airport at Hope. Plus there's about, several thousand that have never, they've not even ripped the labels off the microwaves because they've never been in. And when I was down here recently and over in Mississippi recently, I learned that there are still people learning that they are in formaldehyde-contaminated trailers. And so they're going to have to vacate them. They don't know where they're going to go. So I think that we need to clean that up and figure out what to do with that eyesore and know where people are on their long-term housing. But all of this could be handled if you had a president who was committed and you had, it really does matter if you have a White House person whose job it is to drive this. I could give you five examples of that from my presidency where it was obvious we were going to have a problem that was way bigger than we thought. Like when California had an earthquake, a fire, and three or four other things happened at once, they had everything, as they joked, except a plague of locusts. So we finally just said, look, this is a huge part of our economy. We better have somebody that thinks about this all day, every day. And we made a coordinator for all these various California releases. And we got much quicker results. And we moved the thing because there was somebody there who had to answer to me on a regular basis about whether we were going to put that state back on its feet. And it was important to every state in America because it was such a big part of our economy. And I could give you, like I said, several other examples. So I think that's the most important thing. Well, I think that he, first of all, I like him, as you may know. I've said repeatedly, I think he was a good appointment by President Bush. But first, he was doing it as more or less a volunteer capacity and in trying to get everybody together. This would be a full-time staff person in the White House who had to answer every day to an insistent president or chief of staff. Where are we on this? I want weekly reports. What's the difference in where we are this week and last week? how much money has we moved, how many houses are building, how many of them are green, what's the holdup, do we have new building standards, is there anything the federal government can do about this, boom, ba-da-doom, ba-da-doom. What about a partnership with the electric company? Have we done anything to try to accelerate the green efficiency? If you had this stuff where it's just relentless, you just can't imagine what a difference it makes. And Don was never asked to do all of that. He was asked, keep in mind, when he started, we were nowhere in terms of cooperation, and we had a state program, and there was some debate about that. We had a city effort and a city planning commission, a state planning commission, and nobody knew what the federal response was going to be. This was when he came in, it was even before all the federal laws had passed. So I think President Bush actually did a very good job getting him. I'm very high on him. But we know that the laws have been passed, the money has been appropriated, and now we just need to get the show on the road. And the quicker the better without messing it up. So that's from my experience, that was the most effective way to do it. Thank one you. More? Yes, in the back. One last question. I'm sorry, go ahead. I think what would?
Sorry, I'll make sure I have you. Do you think that bringing all these students together around the country, around the world, could rally more students to your White's campaign?
First of all, if you look at the number of students that are involved in her campaign and Senator Obama's now, they dwarf the number of students that are here at CGI. So I don't necessarily think so. I think that I think she and Chelsea have done a good job of reaching out to young people, and that they haven't been outdone in a way that they got routed ever since it happened in Iowa. So I think they're doing better. But I think the most important thing is that young people feel that they're welcome in these political campaigns, and that their ideas and energies are welcome, and that the candidates, if elected, will be relentlessly focused on their future. That's what I think the most important thing is. I mean, you know, I realized once, and I still do it every now and then, like I did in there in the meeting, that I made people uncomfortable, some people, when I said that every person who lives a life of any length, reasonable length, at some point during that life realizes you have more yesterdays than tomorrows. And it was like I was being morbid, but I'm not. First of all, in my religious tradition and in the psychology of my family, because my father died at 29, 3 months before I was born, I've always been at home discussing this, so I don't mean to be morbid at all. Okay? It is a fact that all human bodies have a duration of time they last, after which they don't. Okay? The most exciting thing is the fastest growing group of people in America, in percentage terms, are people over 85. A lot of the young people that are here today at this meeting will live to be 100 years old or more. A lot of them, not just a few, a lot will live to be 100 or more. Nonetheless, at some point you realize that even if you live to be 100, you have more yesterdays than tomorrow. And then, and as I say that out of gratitude, not out of being morbid, and when that happens, what you really want to do is to just see young people empowered to live their dreams. You want other people to have the same chances that you've had. That, I think, is the most important sense that all these campaigns should be trying to give the young people of America. That and actually getting them to sign up, because we now have, reasons of technology savvy alone, we desperately need armies of young people going against these problems that we're discussing here today and a lot of the others that America has that aren't on our agenda. Thank you.